The following podcast is a presentation of the Washington College of Law at American University. Any unauthorized use or distribution is strictly prohibited.
Here today.
Yeah.
Because it's confusing, I think.
Yes.
I think a lot of we were discussing kind of just, we don't know specifically what some of these classes are like, or, for example, patent trademarks appeals. Does that require taking previous courses, or can you just jump straight into that? Is comparative media, types of media, or globally, you know, those type of things.
Well, here, let's take this rundown. So patent trademark appeals is kind of largely a procedural class about how administrative IP law inside the patent and trademark law. So if you're practicing, I wouldn't start there. I would start with a general class because communications law, Professor Phillips can explain in greater detail, is that body of law that describes it. You do mostly the Title II stuff?
No, not Title II. I do a survey course. So I do sort of communications law and policy, looking at everything from you know, the breakup of AT&T to children's television programs. So it's really sort of the bird's eye view of the curriculum. So the goal is really to, and it's what's happening in the industry. I just did a panel today with four practitioners, and one of the themes was convergence. One guy was writing sort of IP comments to the FCC. So it's just this how to be a practitioner today. You've got to sort of know it all, and they're all things that broadcast attorneys are doing now. They're going to wireless attorneys for advice who did it back in the day, right, because they're involved in auctions. So the class really looks at it.
Almost from the FCC person, like if you're in a commissioner's office, all the different issues you might have.
So that's the survey, but there will be, there is not another class in that space, in that regulatory type of course, until the spring there'll be a telecom seminar. I was just told by Dean Farley today that that we're gonna have at least a telecommunications course that will dive more into Title II telephone broadband stuff, and maybe hopefully a wireless class. I don't know. And the comparative media law, I think, just because Carl Monk sits next to me, I know a little bit about it, and I think it's comparative international, comparative, not across. Types of media.
Right.
But I don't know very much about the course. Mike, do you know more?
I don't know very much either.
Yeah.
Probably, I would imagine, mass media, right? It's probably comparative mass media regulation. So TV, radio, so copyright is the basic class in copyright law. It's mostly domestic, although some international will have to be introduced.
As one else, that seems like that's probably going to fill up. What's usually the turnover do you guys find in courses like that with wait list?
I don't know that it's filled before.
Yeah, I don't know.
Really?
It's a big class.
It's a big classroom. I think that should be. I'm sure they'll stick it in one of the big rooms.
Okay.
The 75 has been the traditional cap, but I don't know that it's ever hit that.
Okay.
But Mike's not has to talk, so watch out. It is weird, though, the classroom limits, you see the student limits are often set by the room limit, by room constraints, right?
Yes.
It is room constraints, which means...
It's interesting.
Well, it means one thing it means, if there's really crazy demand that's out of whack with the cap, it can be changed into a room sometimes if that's available. So.
Right.
I mean, if a class says 16 people or whatever, it's because it's in a 16-person room. But if 30 people sign up,
that happened in my class
possibly
last fall.
They can move around.
Capped, and then there were people on the waiting list, so they switched the room.
Okay.
So sometimes waiting list turns into seats, right?
But most, we don't have any. So this is the nice thing about having the 3Ls and 2Ls together when we do these things. Mm-hmm. So my experience has been, when I teach, everybody gets in off the wait list every year. As long as they come, you know. But there'll be a bunch of people that will be on the wait list that just won't show up, and I don't let any of them in. But everybody who comes, so if you're on the wait list on a course, just, and that's a course you really want, as opposed to conflicting time, go to the course you really want. And I don't know anybody that will keep you out of one. I mean, It might be different in other fields within WCL, but IP, I've never heard of anybody not getting a course there.
Oh, okay.
Oh, good.
Any course
there.
That's
great. Sure. You guys really haven't had this yet, but there's a lot of people that just sign up because they know it'll be hard to get into and they don't really aren't sure they're going to do it. They may
try to get into a lot of shopping.
Okay. Good.
So the waiting list hardly matters at all.
Yeah. If you know what you want, just go to those classes. Yeah.
Okay.
You
know.
How big is communications usually?
It's been weird. It's been as big as 45, and it's been as small as 10. So I think I'm in a. I don't know. I haven't looked. I don't know. But it's just very demand. You know who wants to get in there. So I've taught it every different way because it does change the way your class works.
So entertainment is. So Jay Rosenthal is currently represents the Songwriters Guild, essentially. He's certainly he's an industry insider. In terms of the subject matter, entertainment is this kind of mix of contract law and a little bit of IP. So it's sort of what are the things that an entertainer needs, or what does an entertainment company need from the talent, and what if you're representing the talent, what are the kinds of issues that you're going to deal with? So there will be IP, but a lot of it will be the terms of trade, basically. So it'll be kind of a specialized contracts class.
He's coming actually next Thursday. Next Thursday is it Thursday that he's going to be doing the event with Peter.
Is he doing that one again?
He's going to. I think he's going to moderate the Peter DiCola panel.
Okay. So you can have a look at him next Thursday.
Is he the one that moderated that Bach music?
Yes. Yeah. He was. He didn't moderate it. He was one of the negotiators.
Oh. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
He's the guy with the beard.
Okay.
We all
have beards.
Yeah, so you can watch the webcast of that.
Yeah.
That would be the other. So international and comparative trademark, yeah, I mean, I think you want to take the general trademark class before taking the other, because general trademark is offered in the spring, I think, right? Or is it?
It's I hope so. Yeah.
That's trademark is spring. Yeah.
This is good. This is a good innovation, though, because the copyright and trademark used to be together, so this is good. So you guys could take one.
This is
better, actually.
I agree. IP in cyberspace is a class I'm currently teaching, but our new professor George Contreras is going to teach it next semester. It will be. It's kind of copyright and trademark on the internet. Primarily. The way I teach it and the way I believe he's going to teach it, you do not need any prior class. He won't assume knowledge. But it will be focusing on the internet cases and the internet issues. In the so I don't think it substitutes for either copyright or trademark because it's more focused than those classes are. Patent law is the basic intro to this is patent law. Only things I'll say, especially to the audience at home, is you do not need a technical degree to take that class. And in fact, anyone who, it equips you to spot and to interpret patent issues, and there are more and more issues that now, more and more industries that now are being, where patent law is invading. So for example, I'll give you one. We had an event with an alum who's the general counsel of Bally Technologies. They make gambling machines, right? He has the largest piece of his budget goes to patent litigation because as gambling machines have started to incorporate software, software is patentable, and within the industry, they patent that software and then they go after each other. So he showed us, it was pretty amazing that he showed his cards. He showed us. He's a $25 million budget, and he showed us what the breakdown was for what he spends on outside counsel, and patent law was far and away the largest item. Even though he's in an industry where he has to get state approval in every state they operate in, so there's a lot of licensing costs. So that that means even if you're not the patent lawyer, you need to understand enough about patent law to know you've got an issue and understand the nature of the issue, and that would, this class would equip you to do that.
Would you recommend taking patent law and copyright in the same semester?
As a 2L?
You're right.
If you're a hardcore IP and you know it, then yes, because it opens up the 3L. I mean, I do think there are a number of other general classes that you should take, but on the other hand, you can put business associations and evidence off if you want to. It does open up possibilities for the spring, and it does mean that in the third fall of your third year, you're all raring to go for the advanced IP classes.
You could also do it in your, if you know you're a copyright track person, you want to take patent, and you could also take patent in your third year.
Those are typically fall classes offered. Are they ever offered in the spring? The patent or the basics?
None of our classes are really offered in two semesters. I don't think any of the IP classes are. Now, some of the real basic classes, like administrative law, that we would recommend mm-hmm. that you take, I think all of us would,
right.
I think maybe offered in both semesters. But in IP, we offer a lot of courses, but we only offer each one once.
Okay.
As a rule, actually. So nothing that's offered in the summer is offered in the spring, fall, etc.
Oh, wow.
So you'll get two shots in that you have 2 years, but you won't get a shot every semester.
Yeah. This copyright clearance and fair use is kind of a special attraction. This is not a regular class. This is actually, the story behind this class is interesting. Michael Donaldson came and gave a lunch talk, and it was so popular, students afterwards came up and said, "That guy's amazing. Can he teach a class?" And he said, "I don't know. Let's find out." And so this will be a highly compressed event. It's essentially a full day of, gonzo IP.
Two days.
But it's, I would strongly recommend trying to get in. It's already full, but maybe we can, I would go ahead and get on the wait list and see what happens, because it'll be a really interesting experience, and he's a really talented lawyer and a real interesting personality. So
it'll be just on scheduling. It'll be 2 days, a Friday and a Saturday. So most of you won't have classes on Fridays, but you'll have to, if you're going to do a work thing, or lots of students do other stuff on Friday. So it just requires you to keep a Friday, Saturday open in the middle of the term.
Intellectual property management is largely about how companies manage IP assets, so trademarks, copyrights, patents, trade secrets. What is the lawyer's role in helping to identify the IP, index it, catalog it, make sure that you're keeping the IP in force? So with respect to trademarks, for example, you have to file something with the trademark office every 5 years to keep your registration up to date. That's a management issue. How do you keep track of that and make sure that you're doing all of that? I don't know that the licensing piece gets discussed that much in the class. It might be more just keeping track of the licenses that you do and don't have. That's a management issue, rather than the actual drafting or negotiating of the licenses. If you're mostly rising 1Ls, that to me is more of a 3L class. I would get your feet wet with something else first. If you've already taken the IP survey, then maybe you're already equipped for that. And if going in-house is one of your long-term ambitions, it's a useful class. As you probably know, working in-house is almost impossible straight out of law school. You have to, they don't want to train you, so you have to go get trained somewhere else. But it doesn't hurt to, if you know that's your goal. The Advanced IP Technology Licensing Agreements, also George Contreras, new teacher. It is advanced. I don't know that he required any prerequisites, but I would say if you've had zero IP, it's not the right class to take. If you've had the survey, then I think you're fine, because there's a lot of law around the enforceability and the scope of and the interpretation of IP licenses. And so that's what that class teaches. And it's mostly the U.S. We have a class this summer that deals with the international licensing. This is a domestic class. And then international and comparative patent law, even if patent's not a prerequisite, I would treat it as such because you need the patent basics too.
Well, then, I mean, the other, just going through the list, you could, the summer courses are on, on this sheet. So each year we do a summer institute. This is the second year. Each year for the last 2 years, and the last couple of years it's focused on international intellectual property law. And this is basically the first opportunity that you have if you're going to be around in D.C. over the summer to do some kind of more specialized courses, advanced coursework. So if you haven't had intro to intellectual property yet, then you'd be strongly advised to start with the intro course. So there's an intro course the first 2 days of the three-week session. And it's optional for most of the courses, but if you haven't had any, then you would start there. And then there's an advanced issues class, which is basically a bunch of visiting lectures from other institutions that are coming in and spending kind of a day each on a series of hot topics. So we'll be looking at intellectual property and trade, kind of the recent WTO cases. There'll be a day on access to medicines. There'll be a day on the evolving law, both international and national, on P2P networks and enforcement. And then a half day on international politics professor from GW, so kind of the international politics of IP, and then the last day on alternatives for research and development, alternatives to intellectual property. And then there's the licensing course, international licensing course that that Michael mentioned, which is starts essentially with international contract law, and then it moves into kind of the extension of that to international intellectual property licensing, particularly looking at the international rules and some comparative rules that would govern the enforceability of international contracts and licensing. So there's both an international and comparative piece. And then it ends with basically a big negotiation seminar where you try to do the licensing deal. And it's taught by a guy who also, in addition to being an IP professor, is from Europe, is from the University of Ghent, is an arbiter for the WTO. So that's why they have the skills that he comes in there. And then there's another course on IP and sustainable development, which we've had for a couple of years. It's cross-licensed with the environmental piece. So it's basically looking at what are the intellectual property components of kind of climate change debates and various debates internationally about environmental sustainability issues. And the in thinking about the summer program, I mean, the basic purpose of it is a couple different aspects. First is to give an opportunity to kind of do a concentrated multiple shots at advanced courses. So I mean, as you're looking through the course schedule, you'll see that you only have so many opportunities to do advanced courses because they tend to take a whole semester and you have to balance with your other classes. So this is the opportunity to come in. It's 7 entire credits if you took all of the courses. You can take them all in 3 weeks. And it just gives you an opportunity to have way more of kind of a deeper, advanced understanding than is possible during the semester sometimes. It gives you, we make them concentrate in just a 3-week period so you can work the rest of the summer. It's enough credits to get financial aid. So if you're doing an unpaid internship and you need to take some credits in order to get financial aid to sustain yourself over the summer, this gives you the opportunity to do that. You don't have to take, if you want to do a summer program or some summer coursework, you don't have to take all of your courses in one of the specialties. So you could choose one of our IP courses and then go take evidence or go take an environmental course or a health course or whatever. So if you're interested in doing any coursework, and they're offered not throughout the summer, but I think throughout June for sure, I think in the first couple weeks of August, there are various programs doing short courses and some night courses.
Okay. Flip a chair.
Yeah, come on in.
In progress.
Great. I went to 5 because I thought it was that lounge.
And then this summer, you know, whether you do it this summer or next summer, and obviously you can choose to not do it at all. It also gives you a little bit of flexibility as you go on in your career. to think about having a semester where you could do fewer credits because you have some credits on the up front. So some people take fewer class credits when they do clinic, for instance. I can tell you more about clinic. It can take a lot of time, and it can give you back as much as you give it. So a lot of people want to take fewer courses when they're involved in clinic. Or if you want to do another kind of internship or externship possibility or something else that's going to take a lot of your time later on. And some people actually go part-time for one semester later on, which is a way you can kind of save some tuition money as well in 3 years. So it's one thing to think about whether this summer or next summer, whether you want to do some kind of concentrated coursework or put some of those credits up front.
What's not sort of on this list that I think is important for you guys to keep in mind are sort of courses, core courses that are so relevant to these fields, like administrative law, and I think that might be offered both semesters. I know John Baker's coming back from his stint at the SEC and teaching antitrust law, which would be a good course to have in hand. First Amendment law is for media communications work, and for IP stuff is a great course to have. I think that's generally offered in the spring. So I don't know that the spring list is up, but as this just lists the fall things, and as you sort of think about the sequencing, like if you want to do patent and copyright, I think trademark is in the spring, so you could sequence that in. But I would urge you to think of these larger basic courses in addition to your evidence and your whatever we think of as the sort of core bar courses, right? If you're interested in these practice areas, I think antitrust, admin for sure. I might even put that at the top of my list. Yeah. In a DC practice, regardless of what you're doing. So I would urge you to consider those as much as I think I have a preference for the foundation courses first. So I think patent and copyright probably it would be a nice thing that a lot of students do that. But don't forget these sort of related courses. And I wish the spring, if I were in your shoes, I wish the spring schedule would be up because it would help. And I don't think it is up yet.
We kind of have it. So there's one other document that I didn't bring, but it's up on our website that has this breakdown that Vicky's talking about. So we have
when they're off.
As close to a map of courses as we have, which is basically grouping courses into I think we call them related courses that Vicky's talking about, the kind of core basic building blocks that you should need that are not necessarily IP courses themselves, so antitrust and admin law and business administration, First Amendment, communications law, so some of those kind of big broad courses. And then there's the foundational IP courses, which you could kind of think you should take at least one of, but you could take more, but that would be like copyright and trademark and patent. Now we're going to have a trade secret course that probably fit in there. Cyber law might fit in.
Would that be in the spring?
Or would you call that an advanced course?
Yeah, well, cyber law, as I teach it, is actually not IP. It's the IP in cyberspace is the piece that does that. Cyber law does all the other kind of, surveys the other internet issues. So jurisdiction, whose law applies on the internet, what courts have jurisdiction over disputes that take place over on the internet. Privacy, a little bit about contracting, on like the special features of the theory of the class is to sort of look at basic areas of law where there's some internet-specific accommodation that the law has made. So it contracts, property, civil procedure. And so I sort of think of it as the first year in cyberspace. Like, you got the first year classes. Now let me show you all the ways in which they don't work on the internet, and then what has the law done as a response?
He conducts it in cyberspace, too. He conducts it in the second virtual. Polish your avatar.
So those are kind of the foundational courses, and then there's a series of advanced courses, many of which we've remembered, that kind of go deeper in various, sometimes it's the cross-cutting stuff, like licensing, or sometimes it's deeper in a specific doctrine. So all the international and comparative courses, and these are things thinking about more advanced, therefore later in your career. But there's no requirements. So the international and comparative courses, the licensing courses, the management courses. There's a specific course on intellectual property and antitrust. So those vary all the summer courses. You know,
there's a
very kind of more narrow, deep biotechnology.
Do we still have that?
I think that's in the summer, maybe, or maybe it's during the year. There's art in the law, but all those kind of like niche courses that get you deeper into a specific issue. And then there's some other things that you should just think about, and even working now to schedule them, like thinking the next 2 years. So, like when you're going to do your writing. My advice is always do it earlier, not later. Don't leave it to second semester, third L. Even if you can, do it first semester next year, because that becomes a writing sample that you're then going to use to get your summer job and whatnot. And it's much better to have something you've worked on for a whole semester through a course with supervision than using your trial memo or brief or something that's vague, or, you know, those writing samples just don't tend to be very good. But there's other ways.
Too many students who are doing their second semester, third year, and it's
that's
really frustrating. It's bad time.
And the thing is, you have this research paper requirement, and the worst thing is to think about it as a box you have to check, and what's the minimum requirements. The best way to think about it is, you're forcing me to create an asset, and it's an asset that I can use for lots of different reasons. Maybe I can get it published, and then that goes on my CV as an accomplishment. It's certainly a writing sample, and it signals my interest to future employers in an area of law that I'd like to work in. All reasons to put your heart and soul into making it the best paper you can, and then trying to get it published. And there are law reviews that take articles written by students at other schools, especially specialty law reviews and online law reviews, and publications. So I strongly urge you to think about that as a strategy.
The library can help you get stuff published. So in my seminar, I require everybody to submit it to at least one journal, and that often gets them up on a VPress site automatically, so they all get published somehow, because they're self-publishing electronically, which is pretty easy to do, but still gives you a formal looking publication, which is nice. But you should do it for any time you write something, you should just submit it, because the worst thing that happens is don't get accepted, I suppose. But if they do accept it, they help you make your article better. You get students to work on your footnotes and site check and all that stuff you do for other people. Someone else will do that for you. And so it's great. So you get somebody to help you out with your stuff. But so writing, you should think about writing, and through a class is one way to do it, through the IP brief. I mean, all of you should really do the IP brief. It's really great. They do blogs or they do longer pieces, but you just get some writing. And even a good policy blog can be a better writing sample than your moot court brief. I mean, if you spend a little time and it's on a cutting edge issue, and it just forces you to write something that's going to be interesting to an employer. So I would write something next semester, no matter what, whether it's a blog or a paper or something. You got to have something. And you can do them through independent studies, and you can do through joining a journal, of course. And there's the IP brief that I think it's open door. Everybody gets on that wants to be on. But you can also apply to one of the briefs, which you should. Or a work product, of course, like some kind of work product. But unless you're doing an internship in the first semester, which I don't recommend, you'll need one or the other. And then other things to think about, I mean, so skills. So clinic is our flagship skills course.
Really. We don't like the term skills course.
Skills course. Skills opportunity.
Experiential learning.
Experiential learning.
Yeah.
Experiential learning.
Skills.
I apologize.
So I had hoped so much to be able to take 2 L's in the clinic, and I came in. I know you guys are in Carly's class, and I pitched, and we got such... So many rising 2L applicants that as much as we wanted to, we just couldn't, in good conscience, you know, keep me honest. So we had to take all 3 years, and we, you know, it was very difficult. But just in terms of planning for IP clinic, you know, getting these doctrinal foundational courses under your belt, and some of the, you know, the evidence. Which is you know, we want to get you up in court. We need that for student practice rules. And, you know, I don't know. It's skills is interesting. I mean, it's real. So the clients come in, and this is why it's good to have all those courses. They come in, and they've got a little bit of everything. They don't neatly divide by the categories. So, you know, it's problem solving, it's real lawyering, and it's, you know, it's funny. I had a conversation with students this year. Some of them had got offered hoity-toity positions on the law review, and but yet what they really were scared of is not that. Like, they were scared of dealing with clients and trying to make the choice of what to do, and it's, you know, it's just a real different thing, and it's a year long, it's a boatload of credits, it's 14. We're experimenting with a semester option this year. I don't know how that's going to go. We've always, for 10 years, done it as a year-long clinic, and the nature of our casework is really hard to think about what you could do in a semester, because we have litigations and we have regulatory rulemakings and the things that take, they take time just to get up to speed. And then we have a lot of just filmmakers. We do stuff like Michael Donaldson does, you know, filmmakers that can't afford lawyers trying to get into Sundance. They need a letter to the insurance company saying, you know, what's fair use if there aren't clearances for things. And registering trademarks for little nonprofits, you just can't make up the cases with that. They're just crazy. I mean, the clinic this year, we have everything from Major League Baseball to William Faulkner to superheroes. It's why you guys probably are drawn to IP. It's just sort of fun, creative stuff to deal with. So I would encourage you all to think about that as a possibility. And the only it's only a co-requisite for an IP course, which it sounds like all of you will probably have in the bag next year, and then evidence. But the process, I've even gotten emails this week. When is the clinic application process? I mean, it's already happened, and people are selected. And, you know, it's advertised pretty well, but apparently it's not advertised well enough. But it happens sort of, you know, late February, spring break. So if you're interested, please be on your toes to do it, because it's quite a lot of fun. And ethics. And it brings ethics, civil procedure, contracts. It brings it all to life. And it's sort of a trend in legal education, you know, mandatory clinics. Because firms want to hire. And I got to tell you, I've been teaching my communications law class and teaching clinic. When I get a reference check, I have such a more in-depth conversation with a clinic student than someone who's been sitting in my communications law class. I just know that student. I can talk about the cases. Oh, yeah, she wrote an office action response and got a trademark for a client. You just wrote an amicus brief to the Supreme Court. You know what they've done. And as a student, you have stuff to talk about. Mm-hmm. And I feel like a lot of my students have parlayed it into a year of experience in this market has been very nice to help them have that edge. So it's very fun.
What's the acceptance rate for like a rising 3L?
This varies year by year, because sometimes we've been able to take 2Ls. This year, though, it was... it's probably less than 50%. But then I can't, you know, I don't know what the next year will bring, you know. But, and my colleagues, I have to say that I would advocate any clinic. I really would. This Committee of Economic Development does great stuff with local clients. Even the general practice clinic, just to sort of see what it's like to be a lawyer and help yourself. You know, discover yourself as a practicing lawyer and how you are with a client. Having someone walk through the door who's not a tort or a contract, but you have to figure it out. It's really sort of, and it's advocacy. And we try to do written and oral. And, you know, if you're afraid of speaking in public, take clinic, because we'll make you do it. Right? No hiding and waiting till the end of the semester and doing an exam. But I'm happy to talk to anyone more about it, too.
Is there a way to look at IP? Like, I'm trying to figure with, like, you mentioned administrative law. And then, like, if, you know, you think that you might go to a firm route. Like, are there classes? Like, how do you balance IP with, like, administrative-type stuff or corporate law? Or can you do all, you know, can't do everything. So how do you balance it?
Well, I mean, that's, I think, why I agree with the recommendation that you want the general. I mean, you know, you got to think of your JD degree as a general degree. It's like a general liberal arts degree within the profession. And then, so what are the things that every lawyer should know, right? So if you walk into a courtroom, you need evidence, right? Because evidence sets the rules for what you're allowed to rely on when you make an argument. And that's going to, doesn't matter what kind of case, that's foundational. Administrative law is, what is the relationship between the judicial branch and the executive branch? So whatever you want to challenge, what is the process by which agencies make rules? How do they take in information? How do they process that information and turn it into rules? And then what happens when you want to challenge the decision and you ask a court to review it? That's actually almost a form of constitutional law, because the judges can't substitute their judgment for the agency, but the agency has to play by the rules. So that's what administrative law teaches you. Any DC job involves that, right?
Colleagues at Riley, Ryan, Fielding got their challenge of net neutrality knocked out because the order hadn't been published in the Federal Register.
Yeah, right. So
So there's no final order.
Technicalities matter. But it's also at the local level, right? Say your neighbor wants to put an addition on and they need a zoning variance. And if you want to block it, you got to know the process, right? And then business associations, because most of the wealth in the country is held in the corporate form, and you need to know how many of your clients are likely to be corporations, and there are just going to be basic rules about who speaks on behalf of the corporation, what duties do they owe the corporation. That's foundational.
You'll find things like IP and admin law in a DC-based practice. You'll file stuff in the copyright office. You'll be involved. You probably won't be hermetically sealed in a litigation, transactional admin law practice. It'll be all, and I think that's more so lately than when I entered practice. It was a little more, if I wanted to do my IP, I had to go to the litigation floor. Mm-hmm. If I wanted to do my communications, I went to the communications floor. But now I think it's much more, mixed up, which is smart, which is the way it should be.
Right? And then, weird things come in. Like, what if you're in the patent practice and you're doing tech transfer and suddenly you need to do a license that requires Commerce Department export control clearance, and so suddenly you have to run the license through the Commerce Department and you need to know what that administrative process looks like. And with the clean tech, that may be an issue, right?
I'm just talking to a woman at the Commerce Department who's running a program for helping small businesses, one of these sort of, Obama administration's one-stop shopping across agencies, and the list of things that she had on her list, talk to people, and I was sort of the IP call, but it was everything from export control, tax, and formation, and it was all, it was 10 agencies, and it was just, this is just for a little small micro business, and how to advise them, so it's like really... At every little business, you're possibly involved in lots of different pots here in town.
So you can get the, basically, as I think I mentioned, the courses differ between semesters. They don't differ that much between years, and you can get online what was taught last spring.
Yeah.
So you can get a very good guess, 99.9% correct, of exactly what's going to be taught. You also can't. Usually things are actually taught exactly the same time as well.
The only caveat is patent has switched. Patent used to be a spring class, and it's moved to the fall.
Trademark will probably move to
and trademark,
the spring.
So trademark and patent have flipped, but I think everything else, all the adjunct classes, I believe, are still same teacher, same semester.
So you can if you want to be very organized about it, you can create a grid for both years and kind of just plan out essentially what you will take when, but it's at least good to know what's coming in the pipeline, even if you aren't as organized as that.
I need to speak with Professor Carroll for just a second.
Okay.
Excuse me for a minute.
Do you recommend knocking out all the big ones like copyright, patent, trademark, maybe trade secrets, or only if you have a specific interest in that?
It's all trade-offs is the thing. So you got to look at if you do that, are you ever going to take antitrust, and how important is that to you, and how do you feel about administrative law? how certain are you about what kind of clients you're going to represent? Like, if you really know your client group as well, you can think about their interests, you know? If you definitely want to be in the copyright space for entertainers, then you got to have First Amendment, for instance. And I might want that over something else, you know? I mean, so it just, how broad are you? Do you want to be in the firm environment? Do you want to be in the government? I mean, so it's not going to be the same.
I have to cut out. I'm sorry. I forgot I had a 4:30 that I'm way over time. So, but you
we'll
can
email recorded me that.
You have
recording that to.
Right. Thank you.
The other thing you can think about too is engaging in stuff other than classes that might, you know, satisfy a curiosity or or increase your knowledge base. PIDGIP has dean's fellowships, working for a faculty member who's doing research on something you like. You know, I would probably wouldn't recommend an externship to L year, but people certainly do them, especially if you want to do clinic in the 3L year, maybe that is a good year. And these writing samples that Sean was talking about are so important. They so often have been stepping stones to you know, externships. And, you know, I wrote a paper about X, so I interview Gigi Sohn at Public Knowledge, and all of a sudden I'm interning at Public Knowledge, right? Yeah, so it's a good...
Yeah, I was going to mention that, too, which is just, I mean, you know, the other thing, there's a lot of learning and networking and socializing that you do that helps you set you up on your career that there are no course numbers behind, you know?
Yeah.
So going to events, so doing internships, and you can definitely substitute one for the other. I mean, you could do an internship at doing First Amendment stuff at the ACLU instead of taking First Amendment. You'll learn, you know, I mean, there's all kinds of different ways to learn substance, but then also, like, you know, you obviously you're all in IPLS, I assume. They have alumni events you should go to. There's events that you should go to. There's, you know, you can't do everything is the thing. You know, so you need to figure out which you have time to do.
Yeah, maybe student memberships of these professional associations are so cheap compared to, you know, when you graduate, that whether it's the Copyright Society of the United States, which is the event next Thursday and Friday, or if you're into patent, the AIPLA, you know, communications, all the FCBA is the smallest, tightest organization I've ever been involved with in my life, and everyone knows each other. So the stories that I moderated this panel at lunch today, and the stories of how people got their jobs, was all about, like, Professor X, and then I interned here, and then it went, you know, it was like Kevin Bacon.
Yeah.
And it's true, though. It's not, you have to have the merit, but then it's also sort of, you have to sort of, I think, be savvy about putting together a plan of where you think you want to be when you get out of here, and how you, especially now, because it's so tough.
And even where you'd ideally be next summer, if you can write it down, then you can draw. So it's more likely that you'll be able to get it. So if you, if you really want to be in DOJ next summer, or if you really want to be in a specific firm, try to set yourself up for it.
If we were to aim for firms, which ones have IP practices that are, like, I think Dean Shapiro might be coming next week, and I've heard that they have a really big
one. There's a list of them on
They've got alums.
Yeah. They're from here.
Zero in on our alums. Finnegan has a lot of alums.
Okay. There is a list of IP firms at which there are OU alums in the partnership on the PIDGIP Student Resources webpage. So there's one of the links is to, it says something about jobs. And there's a list of basically, most of them are area firms, but not all of them.
Most of the big firms in town have pretty significant something IP practice. Those firms that we just said are sort of pretty much all IP, right?
But there are a bunch of niche firms, especially in the patent right area around our patent.
But even a Morrison & Foerster or a... You know, Mild Firm, Wiley Run and Fielding, like firms that you don't think of as IP have great work because their client bases are, you know, communications companies and they need this work, or, you know, MoFo's in San Francisco, so they've got a lot of Silicon Valley clients. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think what used to have said Howery and Simon, but now it wasn't even Howery and Simon, it was Howery. I don't even know the names of these firms anymore. You know, I come from a world where they were only two names on most of these firms, not like four or one. It either goes to four or it just goes to one, right? Yeah. Hogan does. I mean, they all sort of do it, but it, you know, trademark, I'd say Finnegan is a really strong practice. Morgan Lewis, and they all come to campus. I don't know what their summer programs are looking like these days. If they're ballooning up, or I just don't know. But I think that's a really good advice about really shooting for something next summer, because the deadlines, I mean, the public interest jobs are gone soon for the summer. The free externships are gone, mm-hmm. you know, sooner than I even can. They're like judicial clerkships the way they're going. The other place that I think is really a valuable place to look is The Hill, if you have an interest in that kind of work, because there's great work in those committees, whether it's the IP subcommittees or on the communications and the commerce committees. And those are just always jobs that, you know, if you're an intern on The Hill and there's an opening, you're a bird in hand and you're a known quantity.
How many of you are still looking for something this summer? There's still lots of time for especially unpaid stuff, but in the government, it's always hard to get paid stuff your first year. Does anybody have paid stuff and jobs their first year? It's very hard. Because you start sort of
part-time.
Okay, so that's great. But it's not too, a lot of government offices move on the paid positions really early, but on the unpaid positions really late. So you shouldn't feel bad at all about not having something. But start working now, you know. I mean, you should definitely be sending letters and resumes and talking to people. And then combining it with some kind of, coursework over the summer gives you some other things to concentrate on if you're interested.
Where are you guys working? Just to give folks ideas.
Well, actually, I went to the panel that we had here and talked to the council at the Newspaper Association of America. And she said, "Oh, yeah, there's a project I can have you do." So it was not really a formal thing, but
that's part time.
Yeah. So it was a good plug for the panels.
It's true. Department of Commerce for IP Rights.
Great.
With Jennifer Boker, which actually was like, here's another point for networking is via the mentor database for just OCPD downstairs, which they don't even talk about. Somebody forwarded to me. I called Eric Schwartz, and he was like, "Call all these people and use my name." And it wasn't even
Eric Schwartz's name to call
just
these people.
Using Eric Schwartz, Mr. Silverberg.
Yeah. And
everybody
they hadn't even advertised the position.
That's great.
And there's an alum in that office, Susan.
She's the head of that department,
yes.
I think.
Yep.
There's a lot of AU people there.
There's a lot of AU people in commerce.
We've worked with them before. What we were doing, doing some education of Sierra Leone, and we worked with that office to do training. The clinic was several years back doing some training for some countries, and that sounds like a great place. There's a clinic alum in there.
Andrea Cornwall, met her.
So that's those two.
Finding a place where alumni are, that's a good one.
Yeah.
I have a former student at Comcast who sent an email out about I have a paid internship. You know, and I try to send those on to the IP Society and the Communications Law Society before I send them to Tracy Jenkins. And then I send them promptly to Tracy Jenkins.
Really publishing this.
Give the real believers first crack. But it is, I mean, that is exactly what these people at this panel today at lunch were saying. You know, it's having the chutzpah to just walk up, and there was a need, right? The ANPA had a need.
She's like, sure. And she's an alum, and so, you know, she's very friendly. I don't think anybody else had applied.
Well, and sometimes just going and asking creates the need.
Yeah.
Creates the awareness that, hey, good. That's good.
And figuring out who alumni are and just calling people and asking if you can talk, you know, for 5 minutes about their job, just an informational interview, will often lead to things. Everybody wants to help their alumni. It's one of the reasons you go to universities.
And I'd go back to your undergrad alum. You know, I'd pull all, I'd any contact, you know, if you're reading the Martindale and Hubble of some place that you want to work and you see someone went to your undergrad, I would do that too. Those ties are sometimes stronger than the grad school ties, right?
Yeah, you can search a lot of those databases in the library. You can search for American University. I don't think the alumni office will help you find people, but you'll have to find it yourself.
Any other questions?
Yeah. That's good.
I have one quick question about the writing. So do you have to decide if you're going to do a class?
Yes.
Yeah. Because you have to add like an extra credit to the class in order to do the writing.
You don't have to, actually.
Okay.
I mean, it's an option.
Okay.
And I think it's probably at the professor's discretion, but usually if it's kind of like they're requiring a 20-page paper and you write a 35-page paper or whatever, you can get an extra credit. But you don't have to elect to do that credit until the end of
okay.
the year.
That's
you can do it at any time. You don't
okay.
have to
so
register
you don't have to show
it for
up
now.
The first day and say, I want to do this.
No, in fact, I've signed those forms after the paper's already been written.
Okay.
It's like I actually, you know. And I often, you know, give people credit for their papers without giving them the extra credit. Like, they don't want an extra credit because
right.
you have to pay for the extra
yeah.
credit. So it's up to you whether having an extra credit helps you.
But to do those writing requirements in a class, I would say, is the way to go.
And it's generally a seminar. Anything 2 credits is a paper course, and then you have to just read it for the 3 credits. So sometimes a 3-credit course would be a...
Yeah,
paper course, and almost any paper course that you fill out.
Is it 30 pages on 2 credits?
It's 30
at
2.
Upper levels. But the thing with the upper levels is people think that you can just write a law review article and come by and have a professor sign it. That's not true. You need to really, the whole project needs to be conceived from the start with faculty involvement. And I'm not, you know, so that's just something too. So I have a lot of students who come to me wanting a, I wrote an article on this. If you read the requirements for the upper level, it's actually really different than that.
Mm-hmm.
So just, you know, since you guys are just embarking on that, look at the write up on that. That's, you know.
Do people do a lot of independent studies with you guys or through the bishop or, you know, do you get a lot of people approaching you for that?
I've done a number of them, and it's, you know, it's a lot of times for the upper level writing requirement, and I'm gradually encouraging people to do it more with a class.
Okay.
Unless it's something really specialized that someone wants to do that doesn't fit nicely.
Okay.
I think you can do it. It's just it's a real. I don't know. I mean, it's a great opportunity. There's the externships now are sort of done with these externship seminars.
Mm-hmm.
So there's no need to do that, you know, a faculty independent study for people working at the newspaper
mm-hmm.
association, for
mm-hmm.
example. You could do it through one of these externship seminars.
Okay.
It's harder. I mean, I think it's harder for you as an independent study because you have to take a lot of initiative and keep yourself going because it's not the professors. I mean, at least the way I teach them, I don't know if everybody may be different, but it's hard for the professor to drive a process and not in a class. So if you're really driven, I mean, it can be very good in some circumstances, and I've enjoyed working with students, for instance, if they're in an internship
mm-hmm.
and are going to write a big thing in the internship and would like to translate that into an academic paper,
mm-hmm.
but the internship is driving their schedule, so they're
mm-hmm.
going to get it done,
mm-hmm.
but they need a professor to oversee kind of the academic. I'm really happy to do those because
mm-hmm.
there's an outside, or you just have to really prove to me that you're really self-motivated because it's harder to drive. But of course, it's all for your But so I also agree with what Vicky said about it. Best to do it in a class because then you're going to have a schedule,
mm-hmm.
a structure, and there's directed points when you know you're going to see the professor at least once a week, you know, where most of the independent studies that I've done, I mean, there's this intent to kind of, but then you basically have getting a meeting on the end, and that's it. So it's just harder to get what you need.
Yeah. I guess I'm at the tail end of a couple this semester.
Yeah.
When I'm thinking back, going,
yeah.
When's the last time I saw that person?
I have less like that that's going on right now. I see her in the hallway. It's such a good thing. So it's harder.
Although I'm doing cool, and I'm doing the first one I ever did with a co-supervising with a psych professor from Georgetown. on a children's television issue. So that's been, like, something unique like that, I think you could probably find a faculty member to say, yeah, I'm learning stuff from this site professor about cognitive development. It's really cool. So, you know, and then that's driven by another person, you know, another faculty member, so it's actually moving as opposed to... But yeah, no, I would say be creative. Don't let, you know, and keep pounding on doors. You'll find someone to do it if you have a good idea, right?
All right.
We sit here any longer,
so
we'll get
Sylvania. Yeah, I was going to say.
Just literally bring it out.